Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Francisco L. Borges and the Melville Charitable Trust.
This week on The Wheelhouse. Presidential primary day in Connecticut. For Connecticut Public, I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse. It's the show that connects politics to the people. We got your weekly dose of politics in Connecticut and beyond right here. Yesterday's primary was a watershed moment for voter access in our state. Sure, we know who would get the nominations before we even voted. We knew that. But it was also the first election where votes could cast or where voters could cast their ballots early in person. We had about 88,000 people vote yesterday, 18,000 of them taking advantage of early voting. Today on The Wheelhouse, we talk about the 2024 presidential preference primary. And of course, pretty soon we're going to have Stephanie Thomas, the Secretary of the State. She oversaw it all. We'll have her in studio. But first, we're going to the powerhouse panel. And I'm feeling the power. On Zoom first, we're going to Susan Raff, reporter, Channel 3 Eyewitness News, chief political reporter. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Frankie.
You look gorgeous in that wonderful apartment there with that background there with the chimney and the fireplace. I love it.
Thank you. We all learned that during the pandemic, right? To have better backgrounds in our Zooms.
You look terrific. And then to my left, I'm feeling the power. I'm almost getting lifted out of my chair here. Bilal Sekou, the doctor, professor at University of Hartford, the Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government.
You know, I have to always start off by saying, go Hartford Hawks.
Go Hartford Hawks. Hey, guys, you can join the conversation if you want. 888-720-9677. 888-720-9677. Primary day come and gone. I'll give the first question to Susan. We had about 88,000 voters. Lower turnout. What do you think?
Well, I think because also, you know, you had early voting. So the big day, April 2nd, you know, wasn't quite the big bang that, you know. But still, I think what you said as we came into the show is that this is a watershed moment for Connecticut. For the first time, people were able to vote early. I don't believe there were any major issues with that. The primary was actually earlier. They moved that up as well. So I think this is the kickoff of something that's going to be around for a while, and that is to give people the opportunity to vote.
Bilal, you like to vote.
Yes, I do.
You've been looking forward to this moment for quite some time where we'd actually have early voting. Right. So I got to ask you, do you think it rose to the moment here? Do you think people are excited to have early in-person voting? What do you think about this primary?
I mean, I think it absolutely rose to the moment. And, you know, for me, it was a joy to be able to actually go in and to vote early. As you know, I chair the Board of Common Cause in Connecticut. And this is an issue we worked on for a number of years to actually make this day happen. And Connecticut joined the majority of the country by having early voting. And so we've seen a succession of voters sort of initiatives that have been designed to increase opportunity and access for voting over the years right here in Connecticut. And so, you know, we've got one more to tackle in the fall, but, you know, this is absolutely a great day for the state of Connecticut.
Give me a quick takeaway that you had on this primary.
Well, you know, obviously, you know, when you have an election like we have this year where the candidates are, you know, pretty much have been decided quite early. So it wasn't a lot of drama about whether Donald Trump or Joe Biden would be the candidate. So I think that can have the effect of depressing turnout just a bit. But, you know, still lots of Connecticut residents turned out because they care about democracy, they care about participating, and they want to register their voices. And so that's, you know, what we can hope for. And hopefully, you know, come this fall, we'll see, you know, a lot of turnout because I think this is going to be a really close election. And we're likely to see a lot more people actually take advantage of early voting because we know nationwide that that is something that a lot of people do.
Susan Raff, give me one thought here before we take off here for a second and bring it back in a little bit.
I think all of this is true. And, you know, keep in mind, Connecticut was late to the game, right? So Connecticut, really, most states had some form of early voting. So the fact that we now have it, I think, is a very good thing. I know election reform is a big thing, and we will talk about that later on in the show. You know, there has to be some checks and balances going forward. But I do think that this really gives people an opportunity to vote. And that's something that's very important, not just on one particular day. And they can go to their town hall. They can cast their ballot. I know there's a lot of scrutiny now with those absentee ballots, et cetera. But I think all of this is very encouraging and positive for voters in Connecticut.
My day's already made because I've gotten to talk to Susan and Bilal this morning. But don't go anywhere, guys, because we got a lot more to come, including with our powerhouse panel. But first, we're going to talk to Stephanie Thomas, Secretary of the State in Connecticut, after the break. You want to ask her a question? Maybe you want to ask the powerhouse panel a question later. Give us a call, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677. You're listening to The Wheelhouse on Connecticut Public.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers. So we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is The Wheelhouse, Frankie Graziano for Connecticut Public. Yesterday was primary day in Connecticut. And I'm very excited to talk to the person that oversaw it all, Stephanie Thomas, Secretary of the State, Connecticut. Man, a lot going on in Connecticut recently, a lot of elections, I feel like. So how does it feel to get this over with? We had about 88,000 votes or something like that. What do you think about that number?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm really excited to be here. Yes, yeah. Primary day
is over. And thank
you
for coming in.
Yes, yes. Long drive on 95. I am a little upset that the turnout is so low. I would love to see 80, 90% turnout in every election. But, you know, we knew it's not very competitive. A lot of people said they weren't planning to turn out. But hopefully we'll do better in the next election.
You had 18,000 or so people come out early. It's the first time we had early voting in Connecticut. Man, you come in to be Secretary of the State, and then that happens. That's got to be exciting. 18,000 people. What'd you think about that number?
I thought that was phenomenal. I am so excited that we have early voting. People I met, I went around to some polling places. People were just excited. I think it was Hamden was telling me they had a line at 10 a.m. on Tuesday because people wanted to vie for the position to be the first person to cast an early vote. So I think it was fun for the whole state, and I can't wait to do it again.
Man, that's civic duty at its best right there.
Yeah.
Hey, we had Joe Biden get the most votes in the Democratic Party, and then we had Uncommitted, I think, had 11%. On the Republican side, Nikki Haley got a lot of votes. There was Uncommitted. What were people telling you about the choice? I know we've had Uncommitted since 1979, but we did have that option and people seemed to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I think there was a movement this year. It certainly has been reported in the national news to cast an uncommitted ballot. On the ground, I think most people didn't know about it, but I dug into the numbers just going back to 2008. And, you know, the races were always slightly more competitive. But in 2012, on the Republican primary, we had similar turnout because it wasn't very competitive. So that competition really drives the excitement.
Can you get into the numbers a little bit? If you can't, you just say you don't know. But where these uncommitted votes came from, do we have anything about location, anything like that? Can we go that far?
We will. I don't have that data yet. Election workers have 48 hours after an election to enter their data. So numbers won't be final until then.
All right. So prior to this primary, you testified in front of lawmakers. You say the towns have done their fair share to prep for the primary, but the state hasn't come through for you guys yet. So what are we talking about in terms of early voting, in terms of funding to get these elections off? What are you looking for?
Sure. So the state gave some funding for this election that just passed. And I think everyone knows about the historic investment in our tabulators, which is still to come. So I am very excited and appreciative of that.
$25 million or so to get that done?
Exactly. And we have put in for a budget adjustment to give towns some relief for the presidential election, which we expect to be high turnout as it usually is. And it's a lot more labor for 14 days of early voting.
So just help me understand the landscape of where the funding is at now. I think it's $10,500 for each municipality. But why could that be problematic that people would get $10,500?
Yeah, it's a little low. You know, obviously, people have to hire many poll workers. They need more equipment. They need more technology for early voting because it requires a real-time lookup. And in a presidential election, you know, we usually get about 80% turnout. So we need a lot more money to help with all of those costs.
It's flat, too. So, like, if Bridgeport gets $10,500, Union, town,
yes,
many
exactly.
people might not know it about.
That's problematic. We wrote a new formula. So should the legislature decide to allocate money for the fall, we have a great formula that I think is more equitable and it makes more sense. So Union and Bridgeport don't get the same amount.
And in total, it would be something like $5 million you're talking
I've
about.
I've asked
and
for then, $5 million.
And then $2.5 million maybe for a public awareness
Correct.
Campaign.
Because, believe it or not, I mean, I do believe it, a lot of people were like, oh, is there an election? I shouldn't say this, but real story, I was in the cafeteria yesterday and I said, hey, did anyone vote early? And someone was like, why? For what? But, you know, that just says this is our office. A lot of voters have no idea. And that's why that public education is so important.
Good news in the fact that democracy is at work here in Connecticut and beyond. But the bad news is you do have some more work to do as you have more elections coming up.
Yes.
So 4 days of early voting this time around. Then we have 7 if there are August primaries.
Correct.
That'll be in the federal races. And then 14 for the presidential election.
It's a lot of hours.
So did this help you in any way, having 4 days now in terms of...
It did. We definitely have been working in lockstep with the registrars of voters. We've had dozens and dozens and dozens of calls, hours of training, etc. So this really was a test, which hopefully will help them figure out how much staff they need for a high turnout election.
So any other thing that you saw in terms of how this lack of funding that we have for early voting impact anybody? Did you get any complaints or anything like that from some of the towns?
I have received a few complaints.
Okay.
So.
Maybe you could share one with us.
I mean, well, you know, a lot of first electmen and mayors, especially of the larger towns where the $10,500 just doesn't go very far. They have expressed concern about how they can absorb the presidential election in their existing funding budgets. It definitely, you know, I always say someone has to fund our democracy.
Yes.
So it's either the feds, the state, or the towns. But I think we get better economy of scale for a lot of items at the state level.
I sound like such a negative person, I feel like, every time I do this show. So I have to apologize. But the tabulators are a good thing, right?
We're getting...
So I want to preface that. So there's $25 million to get the tabulators. Yes. Everybody complained about the election equipment, something you had to deal with when you're going around debating last year when you're running, or 2 years ago, whatever it was at this point. But now you get the new equipment. So the only thing is it going to be ready? And if it is ready, does it complicate things?
Yes, maybe, no, I don't know. So we are definitely in the RFP process. Once we select the vendor, which our committee, we are hoping to get together. We need it to get through this election. So we're planning to get together within the next week or so. So once we make a decision, it's going to depend on supply chain. We still have to train registrars. We have to deploy and pick up old equipment. So November rollout seems unlikely at this late date, but we may be able to do some towns. It's a big who knows.
But they'll take care of training for you. That's part of the RFP, right? So the vendor will come in and help you guys with training.
Correct.
Because that's probably going to be the big point. Big part at this point.
The hardest thing, believe it or not, most towns don't have enough storage for the old machines and new machines. So we have to coordinate in 169 towns a pickup and a redeployment. And you also have to test all the new equipment.
Logistics. There's always something unforeseen.
It's always in there. COOs are always in demand.
So you say the big thing happening now is everybody wants election reform. It's probably because of the noise at the national level, and then we had something in the local level with Bridgeport. But before we kind of get there, you talked to people about it when you testified, and I don't know if you're being modest or something like that, or whatever the word is. But
doubt it.
But you say that you know, there's always tweaks that could be made.
Absolutely.
So is there any tweaks you could recommend, or you know, are you just being modest? What do you think? Do we need some kind of election reform?
I mean, I believe every system needs continuous improvement. You always have to tweak as you go. Sometimes those tweaks seem minuscule, but they pay off in the long term. I think we definitely can make some changes. There's some clunkiness in the law in places. There are some areas of Title IX that just haven't been looked at for decades. But what I don't want to do is make tweaks based on headlines. You know, we deal with this work every day, day in and day out. We speak to all the frontline election workers. So we want to make tweaks that make sense, that actually solve problems.
So with Bridgeport, that added two more elections to your plate because the state had to oversee that process. So how did that go for you? And is there a resolution? I know there's some frustration on behalf of people in the state as they see that maybe nobody's going to, I don't know if anybody needs to go to jail over this, but that might be one thing, one part that people are saying, that they're not seeing justice maybe for some of the actors that they saw on these videos.
Yeah, I like to do things quickly. So I have had my own frustrations about, you know, how long cases have taken to move through the system. I think with election offenses in particular, you usually need a very fast adjudication because an election has happened and another one is forthcoming. So, you know, I too am frustrated at the pace. I wish it could be faster.
How'd it go with overseeing it, though? At one point, you had to tell voters maybe just to get to the polls, because that might have made things simpler rather than voting absentee in the process. And then, of course, I think some ballots were stamped, right, to stamp them and let everybody know that there were legit ballots. So there's some things that your office was able to do there.
Yeah, we had election monitors on the ground. I chose to, instead of having one person, to have two people so that, you know, we never had a risk of someone getting the flu and not being able to be there. We also had a separate person monitoring all the video footage from the drop boxes. We got a lot done. We did a lot of training, a lot of institution of some best practices, some community education, definitely making sure everything that the judge ordered was being done. We made spot check calls to voters. I mean, we did a tremendous amount, and I think the elections functioned better, and we came up with some ideas for legislation.
So the million-dollar question, I guess, is did anything happen? Did you catch anybody in the act? Do you have some Zapruder film maybe you could show us? Or is everything okay?
I have no secret film. but, you know, people came to our election monitors with concerns. So anything that appears to be an infraction, we refer to SEEK, the State Elections Enforcement Committee. And then, of course, it's up to them to launch the investigation. I wish we had investigatory powers, but we don't. People always call us, like, do something. I'm like,
we
want
you to do a lot. We want you to fund our elections with your own money. We want you to be able to do these, and we want you to be able to investigate things. We're asking a lot from you, aren't we? Stephanie.
People are asking a lot. I do my best.
All right. So this is my last question. So I think we were talking about quick adjudication is something you would like in something like Bridgeport. People were talking about, I think we had some Republicans talking about a mandatory one-year sentence for people that are found to have fraud. So, like, where do you stand on some of these penalties that are being floated out there now that we've had the situation in Bridgeport?
Yeah, so, like, the devil is in the details. That bill in particular, I like the sentiment. We already have very, I think, some of the fines are up to $10,000, $5,000, 5 years in jail per incidence. The bill you're talking about, some of the language is a little loose. It says, any election worker who, like, posts false information or something, but it's missing, like, knowingly or with intent to harm, or, you know, some of this language that is important when you're writing a law versus, like, an article, right, or a press release. So, you know, we're looking and following all the bills very closely. But I do think if people break the law, they need to be penalized.
Maybe I'll give you a final word here. What else should we be looking at in terms of election season and the job that you guys are doing? What's one more thing that you should say here before we let you go?
Oh my gosh, so much pressure. There's a lot going on, but I just hope everyone is focused on early voting. It is a great thing for so many, every type of person. Please remember, vote in every single election. We may have elections coming up in August. So now you can early vote and still go on vacation. And also, of course, in November. So please get involved and check out our civics101.ct.gov website for plain English ways to get involved and learn about elections.
Secretary of the State Stephanie Thomas is doing all the civics, all the elections at once, it seems like, here. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for coming on The Wheelhouse.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. So we had Stephanie Thomas in studio. So glad to have her. Up next, a powerhouse panel. We're going to have Bilal Siku. We're going to have Susan Raff and Mark Pasniokas on. Contextualize some of the things we talked about with Secretary Stephanie Thomas. I can't speak this morning. And they'll tell us all about their coverage of the primary. Join the conversation, 888-720-9677, 888-720-9677.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
If you've never donated to this station before, that's okay. Public radio is available to everyone for free. But we do rely on listener support from those who are able to give. So join the community of supporters for Public Media Giving Days. And thanks.
Give now at ctpublic.org/donate.
This is The Wheelhouse from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Frankie Graziano. We just heard from Connecticut's top election official about Connecticut's presidential preference primary. So we're going to talk now with the powerhouse panel to try to contextualize things. You like the powerhouse panel, huh? Mark Pasniokas, to my left, he's joining me in studio. Mark, how are you? Connecticut Mirror.
I'm fine, other than a slight head cold, which is my souvenir of a nice vacation.
Yeah, you went to Hawaii. And and the guy worked in Hawaii, so give him some credit. He did work for us in Hawaii.
I did. Unfortunately, I wrote Joe Lieberman's obituary from Hawaii, and actually on a few days before we were supposed to continue our conversation about no labels. So it was, I will admit, I was somewhat rattled by the senator's passing.
There's just that theme with the senator's passing, that there was some unfinished business. We had that conversation in a pre-interview that we had. So sorry that that you had to do that work, but thank you for doing it for us.
Well, you do what you do.
Another person who ended up covering the funeral of Joe Lieberman was Bilal Sekou. I think he did that for NBC 30. He's all over the place nowadays. Bilal's back with the powerhouse panel. University of Hartford's Hillier College Associate Professor of Politics and Government. You could say go Hawks one more time if you want.
Go Hawks. Go Hawks.
And on Zoom joining us today, Susan Raff, Chief Political Reporter at Eyewitness News Channel 3. Good morning, Susan. You're back.
Good morning. I'm back. And I agree with Mark. It was quite a surprise about Joe Lieberman. Very unfortunate. But the funeral really gave you a sense of how politics had changed over the years because, you know, despite their differences, people really came together and liked him as a human being.
They did. And it was very interesting to see Ned Lamont. He did a speech there. We talked to him on the show. A lot of people are asking Ned for his comments. It's probably awkward, but he's doing it nonetheless. So I don't know if there's one more thing you all want to say about Joe Lieberman before we move to the business at hand, because this is really big news.
Well, the fact that Ned Lamont was invited to speak at the funeral does say a lot about Joe Lieberman and his widow, Hadassah, as well as Ned Lamont. And of course, Ned Lamont was almost caricatured because of his challenge to Joe Lieberman for U.S. Senate from the left as an anti-war candidate. But the reality is, you know, as governor, Ned Lamont has really emerged more as a centrist Democrat. And that was part of my last conversation with Joe Lieberman. He was quite taken with the fact that this man who had challenged him from the left in a U.S. Senate race was governing in a way that Joe Lieberman was very comfortable with.
Bilal, do you have any takeaways from the funeral? And
I
everything?
Think, you know, what hit me on that day was, you know, obviously these were people who were there who said, look, we had our differences with Joe Lieberman, but, you know, and certainly differences around the Iraq War, the No Labels organization, his sort of leaving the Democratic Party. I think he spoke at the Republican National Convention and actually campaigned for McCain. And so, you know, there were clear differences and he had, you know, ventured away from the party. But I was also struck by the fact that they found him to be a fundamentally decent human being. And one of the things that struck me was just how often they talked about how decent he was, how caring he was. And so, you know, we're all complicated people. And I think that really showed in their discussion.
Susan, in terms of legacy for Joe Lieberman, this wasn't talked about a lot until we started having people to interview like Richard Blumenthal, who's known him for 50 years. The legacy of the Attorney General's office in Connecticut and that role beyond, because Connecticut has such a big impact on the 50 states in terms of prosecuting the government or whoever they have to sue here or these companies or whatever. And then, of course, we have Long Island Sound and the environment, because Joe Lieberman cared very much about the environment. What are you going to remember in terms of Joe Lieberman's legacy, Susan?
Right. And Homeland Security, a lot of people may not be aware of that after 9/11, post-9/11. You know, this was a politician who served Connecticut for over 50 years. I think you'd be hard pressed to find anyone in Connecticut who didn't know who Joe Lieberman was. But he was considered a maverick. So was Lo Weicker. You know, they both became independents and isolated or alienated them, or he certainly did, from the Democratic Party. But I think overall, when you look at his legacy, and the fact that at that time, even Ned Lamont would tell you, and even Chris Dodd would tell you, that despite their differences, you know, people back then could put their arms around each other and agree to disagree. And we don't see that in politics anymore. So it is kind of an end of an era. But I think he had a huge impact on Connecticut.
He also redefined the office of attorney general. It was a part-time job until Lieberman came in. And Lieberman was one of the early vanguard of state attorneys general who became a counter to the Justice Department in Washington, you know, particularly during the Reagan years. So, I mean, we forget about that, but he played an important role in establishing those offices as the center of power in the United States.
So, and now that legacy is with William Tong. That's such a visible position as well to the Attorney General, and Joe Lieberman has really that influence over it. So glad that we got to talk about Joe Lieberman today. Pay attention to Bilal's work with NBC 30, of course, Susan's work with WFSB Eyewitness News, and the obituary that Mark Pazniokas wrote at ctmirror.org. ctmirror.org. All right, we're going to talk about this primary. Paz, you weren't here for the first part of the Powerhouse panel, so I want to get your takeaways now. I'm interested to hear what you had to say about the primary, your opening thoughts about the primary.
There wasn't a whole lot to analyze. Let's be honest, right? Both Trump and Biden had clinched their nominations a while ago. It was a small turnout. It was less than 10% in both the Democratic and Republican primaries. So the things of note, you know, there was signs of dissent in both parties, votes for uncommitted slates in the Democratic primary and votes for Nikki Haley, 14% of the vote for a woman who dropped out a month ago. The only other thing I noticed was if I look down at Lower Fairfield County, you know, what used to be the Republican stronghold, you know, you're talking about Greenwich, Darien, Wilton, Westport, Weston, those places. Trump, even with no real opposition, you know, he had a people vote for up to 30 to 40% of the vote for someone else. And as far as the raw vote, there were more Democrats who turned out for Joe Biden in those communities than Republicans who turned out for those communities. So that reminds us of how Connecticut has shifted and how Fairfield County has shifted. The politics have changed in Connecticut over the years. It's something that was happening prior to Donald Trump's election in 2016, but it certainly accelerated during the Trump years.
I want to get all your thoughts on the conversation that we just had with Stephanie Thomas. We're going to take a caller in a moment, but before we do that, I want to just kind of briefly, I don't know, come down from that conversation that we had in with Stephanie Thomas. There was a lot of news nuggets in there, but the funding, we asked Governor Lamont about this last year about the tabulators. They ended up giving the money for the tabulators, but they were sort of exasperated, I feel like, that they had to give $25 million for the new machine. So now we're talking about getting more funding for early voting, and there's not enough money there, and there's almost like this screaming into the void that the office is doing for the Secretary of the State. So what do we all think about this support that they're calling for, and whether it'll come from lawmakers at some point?
Early voting is a mandate by the state on the cities and towns, clearly. And even by Stephanie Thomas's account, they've only provided at best half the funding that'll be required to conduct for the general election 14 days of early voting. And, you know, Stephanie Thomas had recommended, let's start with 10. And they went with 14, in part because Senator Chris Murphy was pushing very hard for that. But it's always been a shared expense. Elections in Connecticut are essentially a local function. You know, we talk about the Secretary of the State as the chief elections officer, but their elections unit is something like a dozen people. So these are really local enterprises. So when the state changes the rules, it's the cities and towns who have to pick up the bill. And there's going to be some tension about that. And I know Secretary Thomas is doing a conference call debriefing with the local officials, trying to get a better handle on what they learned with this very limited experience with early voting of only 4 days.
Susan, what did you hear when the secretary spoke to me earlier? What did you take away from it?
Well, I took away that obviously she's a huge supporter of early voting. Lack of federal fund or state funding is important. You know, certainly as we expand, the general election will be a whole different ballgame than the primary, clearly. The tabulators, you know, how many of them can they really afford? They're very expensive. I think we had a chance to see some of them when they were displaying them at the Capitol this year. And then there's, you know, election reform. They need some money for that as well. So my takeaway was that, you know, they need some more funding for the cities and towns to unveil this and make sure, because, you know, people want to make it clear that their votes are counted and safe. And there are those who will try to say that there are issues and problems, and that just creates, you know, instability, I think. Yeah.
Can I just, yeah, you know, very quickly,
I
see this, you know, through the lens of, you know, both as an academic who teaches, you know, about elections and wants to work hard to encourage students to become involved. And I also see it through the lens of someone who has been an advocate over the years to really push. It's really troubling to me that the state has not put the money there to make this work. And I think, you know, part of the difficulty of this, of course, is that if things go bad, you know, with any of this, you know, if it turns out we have chaos, you know, when it comes to machines breaking down, if we have problems with, you know, people raising questions about the early voting process, I think in the long run that harms our election system. And of course, we're dealing with a larger sort of national context in which people raise doubts about election, the integrity of elections. And so getting it right is critically important. And so, you know, for me, it's really disappointing that the resources are not being put there. This is the most fundamental and basic right that citizens have in a democracy, which is to exercise their right to vote. If we don't get anything else right, we need to get this right.
Let's talk now about the experience of the election, the primary election. I'm going to ask Susan about her experience covering it and then Bilal actually voting in it. But before I do that, let's go to Will from Norwich. Will was actually working at a poll, as I understand it. And what do you want to tell us, Will?
Yeah, I've volunteered the past couple of years working the elections in Norwich.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. Thank you for doing what you do. And I love the fact that we have the early voting, but I do worry about the load on the towns. The registrars have a hard enough time getting people to volunteer for the normal elections, let alone the early voting. And even in a town like Norwich, it's, you know, especially with the presidential election, it's probably $1,000 just to pay the election workers a day. And we're a small town. I can't imagine the larger towns. And I just worry about it being, you know, you always hear the unfunded mandate kind of thing. And I also worry about the load on the registrars. This, you know, besides needing the election workers, you know, the local registrars of voters are also getting slammed with all this extra work. And the towns just have a hard time, you know, affording that and compensating everybody.
Will, is there one particular aspect that was hard this time around with early voting or anything like that, or in general that you all are dealing with that you could share?
I think, you know, I voted early. It was a very painless process. You know, check in, get your ballot. They check you on the list, make sure you're marked so you can't go vote again. Very important. So that went very smoothly. Again, I guess it's just the load on the town, on the registrars and the volunteers and paying for it.
Hey, thank you so much for calling in this morning, Will. We appreciate it. And that's a good call from Will, because not only are you dealing with your actual job, but now you're going to have people scrutinizing the heck out of you, particularly after 2020. We talked to, on a national show recently, we were talking to academics who were really concerned about political violence against poll workers and things like that. So let's drill in on this experience a little more. Susan Raff, Eyewitness News, Channel 3, they sent you to, I understand, or maybe you pitched it, you went to Vernon. How did that experience go? What were people telling you there about the early voting process?
Well, you know, they were getting their ducks in order when we were there. And, but, you know, I think what Stephanie Thomas said is very true, and that is a lot of people don't know about early voting. Also, there are a lot of people in Connecticut who don't know about the rules about voting in a primary. As you know, Connecticut doesn't have an open primary. So you can't not be a registered Republican or Democrat and not vote. And I think that's very important. And I heard that from some voters. And I think that it's kind of a catch-22. They need more education out there, but they don't necessarily have the funds to do that. But I think that's very important as we go forward. If you want to get a better voter turnout, you have to let people know that that's available for them. And there are probably a lot of people who don't know that. I also see, as far as early voting, when talking to voters, that, you know, there are people who like this flexibility. And then there are people who just want to vote on election day. There's something exciting maybe about that. I like to vote in person. Maybe it's the bake sales. I don't know, at the school. But there are people, and it gives you the opportunity to do both in Connecticut, which I think is really great. So I think people are appreciative of that, and knowing that maybe if they can't vote on that particular day, that they have some flexibility. And overall, I think that voters are pretty happy about some of the changes.
There'll be plenty of education and outreach in November because it's a contested election. So the thing that was missing during this primary was outreach by the parties. There was no get out the vote effort. That will happen for any place where there's a primary in August, for state legislature, for example, and even more so in November. So I think there'll be a great deal of awareness prior to the November election about early voting, because the parties, both parties, will be reaching out to their people.
We're so connected here on this powerhouse panel. There's so much cohesion. Some people are even using Twitter, maybe, or something like that. They're using the word synergy, because Susan Raff was in Vernon covering the early voting in the primary election, and Bilal Sekou voted over there in Vernon. What'd you see?
Yes, I mean, it was a great day, you know, for me, obviously having that opportunity to do something that most Americans, the overwhelming majority of Americans, have the opportunity to do. And I think both Susan and Pass really struck on something that I think is really critical, is about the information and the education around early voting. And I think in general around voting, you know, just as a real goal that the secretary should have, in terms of, especially with young people. But I tell you, not only past the information that come from the parties about this, but one of the things I was struck by, I actually had to go on the Secretary of State's website in order to find out where I should vote, because I got no information from the city of Vernon about where to go, right? Because my polling place had actually changed from where it usually would be, which is the place I would have instinctively gone to try to do this vote. And so it was really surprising to me that the city itself had not sent out some sort of a card or something to all the people, you know, in the city, especially people who are registered with the parties. As Susan has pointed out, not everyone can vote in the primaries. But, you know, that kind of effort is just so critical to making something like early voting successful, and also providing that education that the public needs about elections, the importance of elections. Really getting that information out and doing that public education work, I think, is just critical. And the Secretary of State's office needs more resources, but it needs to go on in our schools. It needs to go on throughout our society in ways that it just simply does not do.
And Stephanie Thomas.
Jill, can I interrupt? Did you not get something in the mail, Bilal? Because when we were in Vernon, they gave us a brochure that they said they were mailing out. It came from the registrar's office. Did you not get something?
No, I didn't receive anything. Nothing told me. And again, I went to the Secretary of State's website, and that's where I found the location, and that's how I ended up going there. And again, I live in an apartment. People who own homes are treated a lot differently in this society. So maybe it went to homeowners. I don't know. But it didn't come to me.
Or they found out that you like the Ohio State University Buckeyes.
Exactly.
How'd they do in the tournament, by the way?
No, but that's important, right? to get something. Yeah. In the mail, because the polling places had changed, you know, so a lot of people would think that they normally vote at their school or wherever. In this case, it was really town hall. And I remember when we were there, and I was told that several towns were doing the same thing. So it's something to follow up on, because as we go forward, that's going to be, you know.
Unlike a regular election, early voting, there's one polling place. You know, communities of a certain size have the option to do more than one, but I believe every place in Connecticut, it was a single one.
Yeah, and that's another critical issue. I know when we were advocating on this issue, one of the things we talked about, the needs of a town like Derby would be different from the needs of a town like Hartford or Bridgeport or New Haven, which are larger cities. And we know a lot of people in those cities don't have access to automobiles. They rely on public transportation. The ease of sort of getting into polling places can be a bit more challenging.
Sometimes mobile voting stations, too.
Exactly. And so the need for, like, mobile voting stations or even multiple, locations where people can vote. So if there's something that's accessible, say on the north end of Hartford, for example, that can make the difference in terms of increasing, you know, voter turnout and easing access.
But right now they're getting $10,500, and so is Derby, the smallest city in the state. I got to switch up a little bit. We got some news in there from Stephanie Thomas. Tabulators probably not going to be, may not be ready for the November election. I wonder if that is somewhat of a good thing, because there won't be the training process or anything like that that you have to endure. It might not complicate things. What do you think, Mark?
That's really a back office function, right? The tabulators, it's not the interface with the voters. That's the most important thing. It's still going to be paper ballots. You're going to go in, even if they have the new tabulators, it's simply where that piece of paper gets into. So whenever they finally get them, and yes, they should be ready and trained to do it. Because as Bilal said, in this environment, you know, elections are always messy things. And the problem today is any little mishap suddenly becomes a question of suspicion. You know, what's up with that? And unfortunately, I think we're going to be living with that for a long time. And so it is important, as Bilal said earlier, it is important that these things go as smoothly as possible so there is confidence. It's very important for the people of America to be confident in their election system. And of course, you know, President Trump has done everything he can to undermine that confidence. So, you know, that's going to be a continuing struggle in America.
We're going to wrap up the early voting talk with this. A significant event for some voters. I saw that two of my Instagram buddies, local journalists from New Haven, Lucy Gelman and her husband, Tom Breen, did their usual Instagram posts that they do. They usually go to these elections, generals and primaries, slap a sticker on their face that says, "I voted today." Something different about this photo, though, wasn't the actual primary day they did early voting. Second, there was a baby in the shot.
So Avi is a New Year's baby, and this is his first election, but hopefully the first of very many elections. I know this sounds silly because he's so little and he's not going to remember it at this point, but like, we want to promote civic engagement in every aspect of our lives, including for our child. We want him to know that his voice matters.
20 seconds each of you. I want to know the relevancy aspect. That's why we moved this thing back 4 weeks or something like that. Susan, do you think we're a little more relevant now that we had the primary a little earlier?
You know, my answer is I'm not sure.
That's fair.
I'm not. Connecticut has never been a huge player in the primary, given the time and the size of our state, and maybe the way we vote. But I'm not sure. You know, I think the hope was maybe the candidates would, you know, maybe more money or the parties. I haven't seen any evidence of that. I didn't hear the Secretary of the State say one way or another. So I guess my answer is I'm really not sure if moving it up a month made a big difference.
Mark?
No, it made no difference. No, I mean, primaries are front loaded now. Remember, in 1968, the California primary was held in June. The question of who was going to be the Democratic nominee for president in 1968 was still up in the air in June.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, February and a little bit into March. And so, yes, Connecticut will try to get the parties to put them on the early schedule. But, you know, unfortunately, no, Connecticut was not relevant.
We only have a few minutes left, so I'm going to whip around a little bit because there's some important things we still have to cover. We now have numbers on how many people voted uncommitted, about 11% in Connecticut. And 1 in 10 Democrats nationally voting uncommitted over Joe Biden. There was some uncommitted in the Republican primary as well, about 5%. So this mostly has been to send a message to the White House about what's happening in the Israel-Hamas conflict. So Munji Dewedi is a member of a coalition that organized the local uncommitted effort, the Connecticut Palestine Solidarity Coalition.
What is happening is unbelievable. Seeing people being slaughtered and killed and pushed to the borders and being starved to death. But what's even more devastating is the reaction from our elected official.
What do you think, Bilal? And what could this mean for November?
Yeah, I think the real question is the people who voted uncommitted, will, when November comes around, for example, will they see the threat of a second Donald Trump term to be more of a danger to them and the country and their interest in policies in the Middle East? or will they see, you know, four more years of Joe Biden being, you know, okay for them? He doesn't have as enthusiastic a base of people who are supporting him, but that wasn't the case even in 2020. But I think at the end of the day, most people who are voting uncommitted will return to the party and vote. I think, though, the real risk that Joe Biden faces is that, especially among a lot of young people, they may simply not show up at the polls. So I don't think the threat is that they will vote for Donald Trump. I think the threat is that they won't show up at the polls, and he really needs those votes in order to win.
And the Democratic Party says they're going to work to turn those uncommitted votes into votes for Joe Biden. I asked the Democratic Party and the chair about that, and that's what they said. Really quickly, what do you think about Nikki Haley getting 14% and yet 5% uncommitted in the Republican primary?
It shows the disappointment in the Republican Party that Donald Trump is their nominee, just as there is a lot of mixed feelings at best in the Democratic Party about the prospect of having a man who's going to turn 82 shortly after the election lead their ticket. And, you know, the age issue is also there with Trump. I mean, he's turning 78 in June.
Susan, I only got about 30 seconds to do this. Let's talk about election reform really quickly, if we can. We had Republicans talking about a mandatory minimum. This is all from Bridgeport. We got to talk to Stephanie Thomas about it. What are your thoughts about the future of our elections now that we've had Bridgeport happen and the elections obviously are over there?
Well, clearly Bridgeport's the black eye of the state. Right. And, you know, does it need addressing? Clearly. But that doesn't mean that the whole state is a mess. Election reform has passed out of committee on a bipartisan basis, which does require many things. But one of the things that it doesn't do is try to expedite these investigations, which we've seen for a long time. It does require camera recording on all of those ballot boxes. Republicans still want to see the ballot boxes away.
Thank you, Susan. We had a lot to cover today, and I think we did it. And I'm sorry to cut you off there, Susan. Thank you to Mark Pasniokas. Thank you to Bilal Sekou, the powerhouse panel. Today's show produced by Chloe Wynn, edited by Meg Dalton. Producer Kat Pastor, and our executive producer is my boss, Katie Talarski. Thank you to the visuals team, social team for helping us out today. I'm Frankie Graziano. This is The Wheelhouse.